Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Defending Australia. Last October, jaws around the world dropped as the People's Liberation Army marched through the streets of Beijing, showing off China's biggest and brightest missiles, tanks, nuclear weapons, and a lot more. China's current budget for defence spending is a whopping $178 billion. Now, while the display impressed many, it also sent a powerful message to the world about the increasing military might of China. Not so long ago, China did not boast an aircraft carrier. Now they do. Where does that leave Australia? How capable are we of defending ourselves these days? And how adequate are the resources of the Australian Defence Force? The federal government's last defence white paper was released in 2016 and outlined priority areas for the ADF all the way out to 2035. It predicted that the US would remain the world's preeminent military power, but noted China's military expansion would have a big impact on stability in the region, and it also noted the increasing pace of military modernisation right across our region. But so much has changed in the world since then. Donald Trump's become US president, we've witnessed the Brexit debacle, and now, of course, we're in the midst of this dreadful coronavirus pandemic. So what should the priorities be for our defence force? What kind of role should the ADF play in the Southeast Asian and South Pacific regions? And can we still rely on the US to come to our aid and defend us if need be? That's long been the thought. Do we need the capability of being able to do more ourselves, or even to go it alone? Would we be capable of doing that? Tonight, to discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by Neil James, Executive Director of the Australian Defence Association, an independent think tank covering strategic security, defence and wider national security issues. We're also joined by Professor John Blaxland, a Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at ANU's Strategic and Defence Studies Centre. John, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Philip, thanks for having me on the program. Great to be with you.
Yeah, no, great to have you with us as well. What are the chances of Australia coming under attack anyway?
Look, the old-fashioned kind of attack we worried about in the Second World War, I think, is not all that likely these days. There are so many other ways to achieve political objectives, and war, after all, is an extension of politics by the means. So there are ways and means to do it without necessarily invading a country directly. So, you know, what we hear people talk about, I've been asked this question many times, Philip. People want to know, are we going to be invaded? Can we defend ourselves against invasion? Invasion per se is highly unlikely in the old fashioned sense, because the way the world is connected now, that kind of approach is really not necessary if you want to achieve your political objectives. You know, can we defend ourselves given the world as it is today on our own? We have to ask ourselves, well, what are we defending ourselves against? Of course, this is a really big question. And, you know, there are many different views about what we're defending ourselves against, because as I argued in a recent paper, a geostrategic SWOT analysis for Australia, we're really dealing with three basic security challenges. Great power contestation, and you know, the competition, particularly between China and the United States, but we're also dealing with, you know, looming environmental catastrophe, and we're seeing that manifest to a certain extent with COVID-19 and with the fires of the last summer, and let alone the challenges the Pacific faces. But then the third dimension, I think, is really a critical one, and it's mixed in with the two, and that's governance challenges. Mm-hmm. And here I'm talking about a spectrum of issues. We're talking about criminal gangs, people smuggling, drug smuggling, international cartels, terrorism, counterterrorism initiatives, the whole spectrum of governance challenges where we're seeing it to a certain extent manifest in the United States right now, where governance is proving much more difficult than ever. And this is because of fake news. It's because of the challenges of the state maintaining authority, and that being challenged on a number of levels. And so when you step back from that, you think, well, okay, what are the security challenges we face? You know, because if we don't face conventional invasion like we talked about,
I mean, Australia's never been invaded as such, has it? I mean, not in modern time. I don't mean in the great flow of history, but Japan, while attacking Australia comprehensively across the north and bombing Australia extensively, never invaded as such, nor it seems ever planned to.
Correct. That's right. They didn't, but they did plan to capture Port Moresby, and in so doing, effectively cut Australia out of the war. And that was basically, that plan was stymied by the Battle of the Coral Sea, which is a really very touch and go battle, which was actually tactically a bit of a defeat for the Allies, but strategically a victory because it blunted the Japanese offensive. They then had to try and get over the Owen Stanley Ranges via the Kokoda Trail, and that, of course, was much more difficult. So, yes, Australia. But the other thing, of course, is that Papua New Guinea was Australian territory back then.
Yes.
In that sense, yes, we were. And that was Australian territory that was attacked, and Australians had to defend it. There's a big question about Papua New Guinea and its connection with Australia. Certainly back then, it was not an independent nation. It was very much under Australian government governance. And so, yes, that part of Australian territory arguably one that could have, under different circumstances, been part of Australia for longer, was definitely invaded by Japan.
Hmm.
And many Australians died fighting for it.
Yes, exactly. Neil James, who's the Executive Director of the Australian Defence Association, joins us. We found him on another line here. Neil, good evening. Welcome to belated welcome to the program.
Good evening, Phil.
Hi. John's just talking about the fact that we're talking about the possibility of Australia being invaded. John suggesting that this is probably not strategically likely. And historically, of course, it hasn't happened. From a defence perspective, of course, the thing that made that unlikely in the past remains for us now, doesn't it? I mean, as we're an island nation, uniquely isolated, as it were. Isn't that important? Well, is that important for our defence?
It's pretty important that we're an island continent and also the only island continent that's totally the territory of one country. But it does produce some problems as well. For example, counting our territorial seas and extended economic zones and search and rescue zones and conservation zones, we're responsible for some 10% of the Earth's surface. New Zealand, another 8. So that naturally brings problems that we face that many other countries around the world and even in our region don't. But the other aspect of the problem is people keep thinking in terms of threats, and they've really got to think in terms of strategic risk. The risk of invasion is low, but the risk of other forms of strategic coercion, particularly as we're a country totally dependent on seaborne trade, is obviously there all the time. And that's why we, generally speaking, seek alliances with regional neighbours and with other countries, because it would be very difficult to in effect protect our 10% of the Earth's surface on our own.
Mm. We often talk about the North, John, don't we? And in fact, during the Second World War, I think there was the notion in defence circles of the Brisbane Line, this idea that we would retreat back to a line somewhere around Brisbane and we would defend the rest, but the North was too big, too vast and too sparsely populated and resourced by Australia to adequately defend. So are they old-fashioned notions which we don't think about anymore? And why? And do we ever think about our southern flank, as it were, where, after all, most of the people in Australia live, that is Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide?
Yeah,
and Perth too, for that matter. Yeah.
That's right. Well, you know, because the Brisbane line's a bit of a furphy. Eddie Ward was a controversial politician who loved to basically stir a bit of a hornet's nest with this line.
Mm.
It's slightly an exaggeration to say that there was a Brisbane line. There was talk about what you would do if we were. invaded, and where you would place your resources and how you might contemplate, you know, best allocation of limited defence resources if it came to a fight. But there was no Brisbane line per se. Not like the Maginot line in France, you know. There was no fortress line or line of trenches dug across just north of Brisbane. No one seriously contemplated taking that approach. It was always about fronting, fighting forward, which is why, of course, we fought in Papua New Guinea, which is why it was so important to blunt the Japanese offensive in the Battle of the Coral Sea. And it's why we talk about, you know, the Kokoda campaign and the Battle of the Guadalcanal, the Marines in what's now the Solomon Islands. So, you know, there's a view of the of those experienced in conducting the kangaroo exercises of the 1990s that, that were conducted across the north of Australia, much of a pretty hostile territory and very difficult to live in unless you're a native-born Australian who's actually experienced in living off the land. People basically struggle to survive in the north of Australia in many parts. So the idea that we would be invaded, well, it's difficult to invade. It's very difficult. There's only a few places you can do it easily. And, of course, there's not much there once you get there. So good luck to you.
Go on. Sorry, John.
Well, you talk about the major population centres in the south, and that's where the industrial base is, that's where the population base is, that's where the infrastructure is, and that's where the military resources are based. So the Navy bases, most of the Air Force, most of the Army bases are in the south. Except in the last few decades, we've placed more emphasis on the north, on Darwin, on Townsville, and the bare Air Force bases across the north of Australia. And they've been very significant investments in infrastructure that obviously now need some reinvestment as well.
Neil, given, and a lot of people are already ask these questions on the text and other lines, given the unique geographical position of Australia then, why do we need a defence force if we're in a sense adequately defended by our own natural position?
Well, we're not adequately defended by our own natural position, but we need to actually, think of how we do it. And we actually have some unique problems that lots of other countries have, and I'll give you two quick ones. Our total dependence on seaborne trade for our whole way of life means that it's not as if we can sit here in isolation and just ignore the rest of the world. We need an international system that works, and it works in commercial terms and legal terms and moral terms and strategic terms. 99.7% of all Australian exports by volume and 75% by value travel in a ship. So it's not as if we can sort of switch off and leave the rest of the world to go hang. We actually have to be actively involved in managing, not just in our region, but managing the wider international system from the UN Charter downwards. The second big problem we face historically is because we're an island continent and the world's fourth biggest country, the bits of defence kit we buy have to be able to work in desert, in jungle, in temperate woodland, in reasonably cold semi-arctic waters in the case of the Navy. And it means that when we buy something that works a lot overseas may not work that well in Australia if it's too specific to a certain climate or type of terrain. So it's a very complicated problem, and unfortunately people keep looking at it in simplistic terms. And the greatest example of this is the people who say, why should we spend money on defence? I can't see a threat. Well, the problem is by the time you actually identify the threat or stop arguing about whether it's a threat or not, it's already rolled over the top of you. So you have to manage strategic risk instead of what people think or don't think are specific threats at any one time.
Yes, I suppose anybody who had a cursory reading of what happened in the Second World War with the threat to Japan would agree with you there that by the time the threat arrived, of course, Australia was woefully underprepared.
Well, I'll give you one quick example. In February 1942, we were spending more on defence a week than we were spending in a year in the late 1930s.
John, when we talk about defending Australia, are we actually capable of defending ourselves independently if we did come under attack anyway? Could we do it?
It depends on what you're talking about being attacked by. It's all relative, of course. But we have a boutique defence force, one that is a fraction of the size that the defence force was at the height of the Second World War. So just in terms of combat power, you think about just in land power terms, the army.
How big is the army?
So the army of 1943 was about the equivalent of 14 divisions, a division about 10,000 men and or women with equipment. And the army of today is one regular division and a hollowed out reserve division. So that's at 1/7 to 1/14 the size of what we had at the height of the Second World War. The Navy, we have, about a dozen warships, a couple of landing helicopter docks that in the old days you would have called aircraft carriers, a few submarines. They're pretty good ones, mind you, and about 100 fighter aircraft and some transport and support aircraft. So this is actually for, as Neil was pointing out, a country responsible for 10% of the globe's surface. That's actually a pretty small force. So you got to be thinking pretty carefully about how you use that resource. The thing is, of course, as Neil also pointed out, we're effectively a moat. We've got a moat around the island.
Yes.
And that means that for a long time we felt we don't need to spend that much on defence. And even at the very, very worst case, when it came to the risk to Port Moresby during the Battle of the Coral Sea, even then, the prospect of invasion of Australia was pretty marginal. Most pundits recognise that wasn't on the cards for Japan. Things would have had to have gone very, very differently for Japan. And, of course, the United States would have had to have been much more significantly crippled, which it wasn't after Pearl Harbor, because all the aircraft carriers weren't in the harbor. And, of course, so there's wide recognition that that was never going ever really all that likely. So what have we got? We've got a defence force now of three combat brigades and some enabling elements in the 1st Division, three brigades that are regionally based that we saw doing great work during the fires in January and February, I'll have to say, and some special forces, and then about a dozen warships and 100 fighters. As I say, if you are up against a serious power, that's not going to cut it. And, of course, thankfully, because of our moat and in view of the efforts to have very good relations with our neighbours, and, of course, the key ones there are Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, the calculation is that we don't need to have more than we've got right now. But, of course, as you pointed out about what happened in 1942, and Neil was touching on this too, The Japanese thrust southwards caught everybody by surprise.
It did, and like you read the reports of the time of the war national, the war cabinet that was meeting in Melbourne, where it was meeting in fortified circumstances, and you read about what they were doing on almost in the back of an envelope amount of stuff that Australia had to defend itself. Yep. I mean, literally counting rifles, and equipment, and it was pathetic what Australia had.
And part of it was because we had a lot of our forces deployed in support of the British Empire elsewhere. Mm. We had divisions at sea. We had one division still at Tobruk, fighting the Battle of Tobruk. We had ships in the Mediterranean, and we had thousands of Australian airmen helping to fight the Battle of Britain and battle subsequently from Britain about Europe.
Yeah. Mm. Neil, I mean, completely hypothetically, if China began, for example, developing naval bases on some of Australia's offshore islands, or decided that it was going to station naval ships in Darwin, where it's got a lease on the port, a 99-year lease on the port.
Thanks, Phil. So they'd have that.
Have that. In any practical sense, is there anything we could do about that?
Well, first of all, the lease of the port's a commercial lease, and obviously, in a situation where there was going to be, strategic tension and possibly the threat of war, then obviously we just override the lease. The problem is one of geography, though, as you touched on first. There's no really suitable harbour for a large naval base between Perth on the west coast and Sydney Harbour on the east coast. That's just the nature of Australian geography and oceanography. So therefore, the islands to our north become pretty important.
Our seven external territories don't have a good harbour among them, and that's a bit of a problem. But places like Norfolk Island in the Pacific and Cocos in the Indian Ocean allow us a considerable strategic reach in terms of things we can put there, like maritime patrol aircraft. But the fundamental question really is if we were to be invaded by someone and say it was China, there would be such an international situation that we would probably not be alone. And we would not only be allied with the United States, we'd obviously be allied with Indonesia and Malaysia and Singapore and probably the way China's going, Vietnam. You know, it's not a case of them against us.
Well,
but
isn't this already happening, though, Neil? I mean, you might argue if you're in the Philippines, you'd say, well, yeah, it's already happened. We laid claim to some of these areas where the Chinese have now built built island bases. You know, we said you can't do that. We had no capacity to say no to them. Wouldn't Australia be in exactly the same situation, that the Chinese are not going to launch a massive scale thing? They'll just cherry pick bit by bit. Could we do anything about it?
Well, there's certainly a chance of that, but the South China Sea is quite different to Australia's seven external territories. But the cherry picking, to an extent, is already going on in Antarctica, with the Chinese bases in those parts of Antarctica, which are frozen Australian territorial claims, and no one quite knows which way they're going to jump in the future once the Antarctic Treaty runs out. But the basic problem here is that you can't just look at it as a China versus Australia equation. It's just not going to happen. And if it did happen, it would obviously be such a regional and international conflict or if it's less than war, area of strategic coercion, that we wouldn't be on our own. But it's always worth remembering one simple thing from World War II. The Japanese army of 74 divisions, over 50 of them never left China the entire war. And so that massive surge across the rest of the Pacific was done with a very small part of the Japanese army and an enormous part of the Japanese Air Force and Navy. And the big problem they had with Australia was that they faced a continent that was logistically and to an extent in terms of operational manoeuvre beyond them invading. So their attempt was to isolate us from the United States, as John's pointed out, by the campaigns in the South Pacific. And luckily we were able to reverse that. And these days, the only major thing that's changed in geography since World War II is missiles. In the old days, if you really wanted to threaten the island continent of Australia, you needed aircraft carriers to do it. Well, you can now do it basically by medium and long-range missiles. And that does make a completely different equation on it, and submarines.
I'm told by those in the business, I would love your views about this, that that Australia's submarine fleet might be small, but they're extraordinarily capable, and that submarines are extraordinarily effective as deterrents, partly because they're very difficult to detect, and that essentially if one is on patrol in the northern part of Australia, your enemy, as it were, doesn't know where it is, and therefore is not going to risk putting shipping in its way. Does the submarine fleet, although it's small, less than a dozen, does it provide maritime security for Australia?
Well, the simple answer to that is because of the size of the area to be covered. A single submarine or two submarines can't be in lots of places at once. And it doesn't matter how potent the submarines are, you're always going to have the problem. And you often get people in Australia saying, well, why don't we just buy European submarines? Well, they won't actually work in our waters, and they won't actually work for the ranges of which we'd require them to operate, because they're designed, you know, to work in the Mediterranean and the Baltic and the North Sea. But the fundamental problem we always face is because we're a high-wage country and because, as John's pointed out, we only have a limited number of ships and aircraft and soldiers, we tend to go for a reasonably high-tech solution to make them as potent as possible. But it doesn't matter how potent they are, they can't be in two or three places at once. And that will always be the problem we face, and that's why we'll always be interested in having alliances with both regional countries and indeed with another large maritime superpower, the United States.
Yeah, I'd like to get to that in a moment, because that's an important part of this whole discussion, I would have thought. John, you've argued at length and in some depth about the challenges faced by the Australian Defence Force in relation to its recruitment and retention of people. As we said, the Australia's Defence Force is actually tiny, really, compared to the rest of the world, and even compared to our region. You say we ought to be doing something about that, including having a reasoned discussion about some form of national service of some kind, without the hysteria that normally surrounds this discussion. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so what I've proposed is an Australian Universal Scheme for National and Community Service. And I caveat this, as it's an important caveat, and that is that the idea is it's incentivized voluntarism. So it's not conscription, it's not compulsory service, it's incentivized voluntary service. And that is because we have in the Defence Force three services that are under-resourced. We just don't have enough people in the Army, Navy and Air Force to do the job. But if you go and ask the service chiefs or the secretary or anyone else, you know, in the defense portfolio, they say, John, we don't want every 18-year-old. That's too many. So we don't want conscription. We don't want massive recruitment drives. We only need a small number.
Yeah, I'm told that if you want to volunteer, to get in these days, it's extraordinarily difficult to get into the Australian Defence Force these days because
The
standards are high. They don't take many people.
They don't take very many, but the issue is that they actually need more than they've got. So there's a conundrum there. The standards are very high, but the numbers being recruited aren't sufficiently high. And that's partly the numbers and the dollars as well. But what's really struck me over the last 6 months or so, as we think about the challenges we've faced with the fires and things like that, is that we really have a need for more volunteers in a whole range of areas. So the SES, Rural Fire Service, in the Border Force, in State Police, State and Federal Police, we're actually under-resourced across a whole range of areas. And I actually think there's a strong argument to be made for young Australians to be strongly encouraged with financial incentives to serve their nation for a year or two in one of these national or state service bodies. And that's what I say. So what people in the past have criticised me for going down this idea of national services, and then they think of the Nashos of the Vietnam War. That's not what I'm proposing at all. Very, very different model, where each of these institutions, and there's, you know, a plethora of them at the state and the federal level, who are actually looking around for more able-bodied people to help out, could actually be part of a scheme. And now that we've got this national cabinet that's being institutionalised, it appears, I think there's prospect for us to get that kind of federal and state level coordination and cooperation to come up with a scheme. See, part of the issue in the past is that no one department or minister or portfolio has oversight of all of this. As I say, you go to the defence people and say, look, John, I don't want that many people. I just want a few. If you go to the police, they'll say the same. Border Force, Australian Volunteers International, National Parks and Wildlife, SES, Rural Fire, they've all got needs for more. They just, no, they're all, it's all disjointed. So this is why I think we need some kind of national level coordinating agency to come up with this scheme where we incentivize our youth. And I've got several in my house, young people who are taking gap years and doing all sorts of the things that, you know, perhaps could be channeled into something that is about community service that is incentivized for the good of us all. Neil and I have had a debate about this before, and I'd be interested to see if he softened his view on this, but I think there really is a way where we can actually pull together something that is new, that is not controversial, that gives young people options, and that actually resources us, and that actually maybe contributes back to community with some kind of community building, team building sort of dimension to this kind of national and community service scheme.
What do you think about these ideas, Neil? I mean, they have been floated, haven't they? This idea of let's have a reasoned discussion, get away from the emotive conscription sort of argument, and talk about some notion of national service, which would be, you know, service of the nation, as it were, rather than simply service in the ADF. What do you think about that?
Well, we have that now to an extent with the Defence Force Reserves, and they have an enormous trouble recruiting people and retaining them. The problem when you start talking about national service schemes, be they voluntary or compulsory or universal or selective, is that there are consequences far beyond
even what John's talking about, particularly economics and demographics. There's a bit over 200,000 young Australians turn 20 every year. That's obviously far too many to use even for a scheme such as John's. And then you have all the effects on the labour force, particularly where you've got reasonably high levels of employment, which funnily enough we don't have at the moment. But that's probably only reasonably.
Which is run. It is, perhaps one of the reasons why there's an opportunity now for us to try this.
But all you do with conscription is you transfer your labour shortage somewhere else in the economy. Now, if you do it in the civil economy, it's a bit easier to make it up with immigration and with temporary visas, employment and things like that. But you continually face, the fundamental problem that if they're not willing to do it as volunteers, and there's an element of even economic coercion involved, you have enormous problems motivating people. Now, as an example, during the 1960s, we conscripted one in every 40 male 20-year-olds. The last time we had universal national service, and it was only for men, was in the 1950s. Now, these days, you'd have to have some form of service that because of modern work health and safety and modern equity, the women would be in it as well as the blokes, and it would be an extremely complicated thing to do. Now, it's worth looking at, but there are complexities and problems here.
Massively costly too, isn't it?
Well, it is, because we're a high-wage country, and we pay, traditionally, we've always paid our conscripts the same money as we pay our regulars. Now, a lot of countries overseas that have conscription schemes often do it because it mops up youth unemployment and they pay them very little. That wouldn't be possible in Australia for any number of reasons. But there's a simple fundamental problem. If the scheme is universal, it can't be voluntary. And if it can't be voluntary, you're going to have great trouble with it on a sort of moral and a political and an ethical and an economic level.
How do you propose we pay for this, John?
Look, how do we just pay for something that we had never thought of before? We're talking about a scheme that I think requires some creative thinking about how we pay for anything. Let's face it, though, we are a wealthy nation, wealthier than I think most of us realise. We can actually stretch to make this happen. This is something that is definitely doable. And at this time, when we are looking to when we're seeing an incredible spike in unemployment on the cards for the next foreseeable while, as we dip into recession for the first time in many people's lifetime, I think, while the demand for these services are real and are their felt needs at the moment, we've got ships up on stilts that have just been renovated. We've got hollowed out units in the military. We've got border force that's stretched. We've got SES that are on the ropes, fire services that were stretched, and wonderful volunteers, and I know Neil's one of them, volunteer firefighters, who are putting their heart and soul on the line for the nation, the rest of us are just kind of watching. I'm mindful, Neil's right, 200,000, it's actually about 240,000, I think, each year, 18-year-olds coming of age. There'll have to be lots of exemptions. Lots of people can't for medical reasons. They've got some kind of, a whole range of constraints on what people can do. But I think there's also a whole range of options. And this is why I know perhaps we're misusing the word universal. When I say universal, I mean universally available. I don't mean universally applicable in the sense that you must do it. But I think in the sense that all of Australians have the opportunity to play, be it 18-year-olds or even older people who want to play in this space. And here's one of the things about this, I think it's worth reflecting on for a moment, that there are skills that you get by working in a community group that you can learn, and that they can actually help you get a job later if you haven't already got one. But also there's such a significant potential contribution to community building. And when you look at the conflict that we've seen in the United States, even today, in the last few days, bolstering social stability ideas of justice and equity and about being on this planet together and of being in this country together and of sharing this space, the idea of shared identity is something that in a multicultural country like Australia, we need to find creative ways of bolstering. Mm. And I think this is a very important factor.
All right. Can we turn, let's talk about equipment briefly. Whenever we talk about defence here on the program, a lot of people raise this. They say, look, the stupendous cost of defence equipment these days means Australia is not really in the league to operate these kinds of things. And when you look at and consider that the aircraft, the joint strike fighters that we're buying 100 of, I think were ordered nearly 20 years ago. I mean, we only got the first two of them in the last 2 years. The submarines, they say, won't even be operational at all until the 2030s. You wonder, given the stupendous cost of these particular schemes, the submarine programs, costing some $80 billion.
Enormous.
$80 billion. On something that you won't even have for 10 or 12 years. Do we need to rethink the sort of equipment that we buy?
I think you go ahead, Neil.
Well, I was just going to say, the amount of money on the submarines, they talk about somewhere between 50 and billion, but it's only going to be spent at $2 billion a year. And you can't talk strategic policy unless you talk dollars. Now, one of the reasons we have the American alliance is because it's cheaper. Because if we didn't have the American alliance, we'd probably have to at least double the defence budget, perhaps triple it, and reintroduce compulsory national service for everyone. So there's a lot of the bipartisan support for the US alliance, for example, is it allows us to actually invest less in defence than we otherwise would. But in terms of dollars, defence is the only major area of government spending in this country, only the federal government does. All the other major areas of major spending, and the three big ones are education, health and social security, are also funded by the states. So roughly speaking, as a nation, for every dollar we spend on defence, we spend $7.50 on social security, $5.50 on health and $5 on education. Yet the average Australian doesn't see that because defence spends its limited amount compared to these other things in a very small number of very large sums, whereas social security spends an enormous amount of money in a very large number of very small sums. And so when people look at what we could and couldn't do in terms of increasing the spending, they're often coming at it from the wrong angle. And it's not helped by governments. Every time they want to announce a major defence project, they announce it once and then they announce it when the contract's let and they announce it when the first... So Joe taxpayer in the street thinks it's extra money being spent every time.
Not that defence is any different from highway projects or new airports, or indeed anything else.
Yep. And then you get to feather bedding where they want something built in Australia because it'll preserve votes in somewhere like South Australia. Mm. And it might not necessarily be in economic and military terms the most efficient way of doing it. And you can't shut a Defence Force base in this country, even if it's only somewhere for historical reasons, because everyone from the local Chamber of Commerce to the Federal Member of Parliament stops you doing it. Mm. So there's lots of things that we could do more cleverly to spend our money. But roughly speaking, the defence budget over the last generation has been somewhere between 7.5% and 8.5% of the federal budget. And occasionally it's rated as a magic pudding to spend elsewhere. But we're not actually spending what we should be spending as a percentage of our national spending. And that's part of the problem. We really need to up it to about 9%, 9.5%. Now, that doesn't sound like a huge percentage increase, but in terms of actual dollars, it would be quite substantial and it would solve some of the problems that John's referred to. I mean, the problem with the submarine program, just as one example, isn't that they won't probably be good submarines, it's just we'll get them too late. The program needs to be massively accelerated.
Yeah, they won't be here for 12 years, by which time, I don't know, no one even knows whether they'll be worth it then.
Well, to be fair, the submarines we've got are pretty impressive. I mean, they copped a lot of flak early on for some teething problems, but today they're world class. They are really, truly outstanding submarines.
I understand that to be the case. That's right. They are.
So we're very well served on that front. But I think there's another couple of points to note here. One, it's very hard to get away from the kind of standard platforms, the ships, the aircraft, the military vehicles, the tanks and things like that. But there are some pretty interesting developments happening now with artificial intelligence, with drones, with remotely piloted vehicles and systems.
That's right.
That are actually enabling us to do some things that really we weren't able to do very well before. So I'm thinking here, the Boeing concept that's been developed in Queensland of the Loyal Wingman that's purported to go with the F-35 and significantly expand the options that an F-35 flying in formation with a bunch of drones, loyal wingmen, could potentially do. Now, the same goes with underwater stuff. There's potential for underwater drones where the submarine is actually like the mothership for a whole, you know, swag of much smaller elements that go out operating semi-autonomously on specific missions. And that's happening with, you know, we're seeing this with land forces as well, with the use of reconnaissance and little drones that can help you see over the other side of the hill, and various other systems that are super empowering, you know, the individual or the small teams to do something that their ancestors could never contemplate. So I think, you know, there's some more innovations yet that are possible. And I think quite a few of them, the senior hierarchy in defence, I mean, it's a bit of a behemoth. It moves slowly, but there is a reasonable amount of forward thinking going on there in that space at the moment.
All right. We're talking about the Defence of Australia. Our guest tonight, Neil James, Executive Director of the Australian Defence Association, and Professor John Blaxland from the Australian National University. He's Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies. If you've got a specific question, I'm very happy to take one. 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. You mentioned the US alliance, Neil, as a cost saver for Australia. How do we these days view this? I mean, is it worth the paper it's written on, Neil?
Probably. And one of the reasons it's worth the paper it's written on is that anyone who would think about taking on Australia, at the back of their mind, has to always have, the risk that the United States and various other countries would become involved. And this is particularly the case with extended nuclear deterrence. If we were to be threatened by a nuclear-armed country, they would always have the worry that perhaps, even though Australia itself didn't possess nuclear weapons, the extended nuclear deterrence we have as part of the US alliance.
Do you think that's realistic? Do you think that's realistic?
Well, there's a very good...
If the United States thought, well, do we really want to go to war against China over this?
Well, the thing is, it wouldn't just be a case of China picking on Australia on its own. It would be part of a wider problem.
Mm.
And it's not just going to be us against the Chinese, for example, or us against anyone else, for that matter. And quite frankly, the strategic problem with China isn't China itself. It's just the way the country's governed. I mean, a democratic China would probably not be a strategic threat to anyone. I mean, the last two democracies fought a war in 1815 against each other.
That's not going to be happening anytime soon. John, what are your thoughts? Do you think the US alliance is worth the paper it's written on?
So I think most people don't quite appreciate just how broad and deep the US alliance actually is. I was a contributing author to a book, Australia's American Alliance, published by MUP a couple of years ago with Peter Dean and Brendan Taylor and Stefan Frühling as the editors. In that book, we talked about the breadth and depth of the security ties to the United States. It's much more than just about the ANZUS alliance. It's now deep and broad on a range of fronts. Interoperability, military interoperability, intelligence, logistics, capabilities. There's a level of trust and understanding between Australia and the United States that is actually unparalleled. We are in a position where Australia is actually closer to the United States, despite what you see on the news, are closer to the United States than just about anybody on the planet. And that's probably even so more so than the Canadians at the moment with Justin as the Prime Minister. And essentially what's happened is that, there was this great campaign last year, the 100 Years of Mateship, which is, a little bit cornball, but it struck a tone in the United States about what it is about Australia and the United States that they appreciate. And this is reflected in, the transactional presidency of Donald Trump. He has repeatedly reaffirmed through his ambassador only days ago on TV, how the United States is committed to Australia in a way that actually belies the wording of the ANZUS Treaty. The ANZUS Treaty is very loosely worded, but the Americans today are so committed to us because we actually have delivered over a long run but they're also heavily invested in us now. Mm-hmm. So as you think about the geostrategic equation now, Australia is becoming almost as important as it was at the height of the Second World War. Mm. And so while there's this contested grey zone space to the north of Australia, the United States has got the Marines here. It's got the joint defence facilities here with Australia. It's invested on a whole range of fronts. That means that now the United States is in a position where it actually needs us as much as we need them. And so I'm actually quite convinced that were it come to, you know, a stoush or some kind of stoush, which I'm not envisaging, the United States actually can't afford not to remain engaged. So even with all this talk about, you know, a retreat of, offshore balancing of the United States, perhaps no longer being committed to its alliance relationships elsewhere, you are not hearing that about Australia, because the United States recognises, even Donald Trump, that we have enduring utility and importance to them.
Okay. John Blaxland with us, Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies from the ANU, and also Neil James with us from the Australian Defence Association. Let's take a call. Jeff is on the line. Jeff, good evening. Welcome to Night Life. Hi, Jeff. G'day, Jeff. Do we have... Oh, yeah, sorry, here we go. Hi, Jeff. Sorry.
Yeah. G'day, gentlemen. Why wouldn't we just invite America to, say, plant 6 bases around the coastal, you know, coastal areas where we need them or where we see fit, and pay them almost like a rent, a security rent, and pay them $1 billion a year, and they can defend us and they can put their troops here. We've got 5,000 in the Northern Territory. I just wonder if that would be feasible, or, you know, it's rather than just spend our money on essentially, it's just a waste of money, really, 100 planes, 2 submarines. I mean, it's really quite laughable. So wouldn't it be better maybe to go down that avenue?
Mm. Neil, what do you think about that idea?
Well, the problem there is there's any number of problems with that. First of all, sovereignty and self-respect in the UN Charter, and the responsibility of any country has to defend itself, or it shouldn't be a country. There's also a geographical problem in that there wouldn't be the places where you would necessarily be able to put a force large enough to actually do the job. Then you'd have to talk the Americans into agreeing with it, which no self-respecting liberal democracy probably would.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you've really got to ask yourself, what would that mean for being an Australian? I mean, if Australian citizens aren't willing to defend their own country and their own society, what's the point of having the country in the first place? So the idea that we could pay someone to come and protect us really has a lot of ethical and moral and political and sovereignty and indeed patriotic connotations that would be just lost.
All right, thanks, Jeff. One caller wants to know, John, the current the pandemic's shown up the fragility of Australian supply lines. Australia wouldn't have enough fuel to support our defence force if we came under attack anyway, would we?
Not for very long. Absolutely right. In fact,
less than a few weeks.
Yes, less than a few weeks. In fact, retired Air Vice Marshal. Retired Air Vice Marshal.
17 days.
Yeah. John Blackburn's been on banging on about this. Jim Molan has as well, as have others. The idea is that we've got this just-in-time mentality that's developed, and it's economically viable when you don't have a threat to your supply line. We now are in the position where we're dependent on refined oil from Singapore and Korea. Of course, what on earth could possibly go wrong there?
Yeah.
There's a dozen or so scenarios that we can envisage that are human-made or natural disasters that could interrupt that supply line. And people say, oh, John, but, you know, we just purchase it from somewhere else. But, of course, if there was a disruption to the supply line from one of those sources, everyone else would be in the same boat looking to buy it from somewhere else.
That's right.
So that argument is a nonsense. We clearly have a compelling need to be able to supply ourselves. Now, part of the answer to that is actually getting off petroleum products, but we're not going to completely get off petroleum products. We need them for a whole variety of reasons. But so in the short to medium term, we need to be able to have a more of our own supplies.
Yes, we do.
Across particularly some of the northern air bases and key infrastructure in the northern Australia. Because if we want to be able to project force to deter a potential adversary, you need to be able to sustain operations. And at the moment, we can't do that from the Air Force bases across Australia.
I don't know what, John, come on, steady. I mean, we've got a massive fuel reserve and most of it, of course, it's in the US.
It's a long way away. From,
I know. I don't know what Boffins.
Have sugar and
I do not know what Boffins thought up this idea, but there you are. Mm. Look, time has beaten us. Unfortunately, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I do thank you for your time, Neil James, Executive Director of the Australian Defence Association. Neil, thank you.
Thank you, Philip.
And John Blaxland from the Australian National University, where John's Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies. John, terrific to have your time and expertise as well.
Thank you very much, Philip.
Thank you. Yes, thanks for the many texts and calls, which unfortunately we couldn't get too many of, given the guests we had and their depth of expertise.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.